Hello and welcome to the very last episode of our Metal Gear Solid season. It's the season finale. It's the big ticket item because we're hearing from you. This is the listener Q&A special where just Blake and I and no guests of any kind are going to hear all your thoughts on Metal Gear Solid, many of which are really interesting.
Have we ever had a guest on a Q&A? Was the doubt?
Yeah, Kat was on the Ninja Theory one.
Oh, okay. And I don't think we did any Qs or As.
Yeah.
Well, what's up, Jacob? Here's the thing, Jacob. Increasingly, we rarely talk just boy to boy anymore. We usually have other boys playing Fortnite with us or guests.
Yeah.
It's never just us anymore. What's up?
And when we do, we are just fucking scheduling this show. It's like we're just being like, oh, this should be the next season.
Yeah, it's like the shortest calls ever where we're like, this Wednesday work? Yeah, it works. All right, man, I'll talk to you later. That's basically it. So what's up? What have you been doing?
Gosh, not much. You know, it's February 5th, you know, like the day of recording this. My birthday is in 3 days.
Oh, really?
February 8th.
Wow. I thought you were going to say February 5th. The day that Jacob Geller LLC paid me for last month. Thank you. Appreciate that.
That's right. And I always do it 3 days before my birthday.
That's true. I have to wait a year to be paid for the show. It's a terrible system we got going. That's exciting. How old are you turning up?
18? Turning 29 years old.
Wow. The same age as your hero, Blake Hester. I'm 29. My birthday's March 3rd. It's coming up.
You know, as you get older, I feel like the age of people that I'm friends with is what, you know, it's like when you're in school, everyone is your age because it's
right.
Like, well, they're in the same grade as you and that's how you know them. And now it's like, you know, I'm dating someone who's a different age than me and like they have friends who are older and younger than them.
She's,
and it doesn't
she's
matter
52
as much.
Listener, she's 52.
Yep. She has that thing that Fragile has from Death Stranding where her face looks very young but she had Timefall on the rest of her body.
Do you have any, like, considerably older friends at this point in your life?
Mm.
You can't bring up the person from the Henson ad, because that was your dad's friend you tried to claim as your own.
Hey, we text. Sometimes we hang out. No, I would say, like, 40 is probably the cap. Annie has some friends who, like, she babysat their kids.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, but now, like, she and that mom are pretty tight. And she's probably, you know, 50-something. But, like, I don't know her well enough to be, like, we're tight.
Oh, sure. I have, like, one very good friend that's in his, like, mid-40s who was going to be on the pod but had to drop for understandable reasons. I don't know if he wants me to advertise who he is plus his age. But it is sometimes one of those, like, weird disconnects where it's, like, I'm, like, still in my 20s, and I text everyone, but to talk to him, we email constantly. Mm-hmm. Or, like, hanging out, because we don't live in the same city, it's, like, works around two children and a wife's schedule, as opposed to, like, I just got to be home to feed my dog.
Yeah.
It's very strange.
It's, like, coworkers are the real, or like, you know, former coworkers or whatever. Like, if I went to Minneapolis, which I'm trying to do at some point this year, I'd probably hang out with both of our former coworkers, Jeff Cork.
Previously
of Game Informer, who's the fucking coolest guy in the world and has, like, two kids and a family and, you know, all that.
That's a good point. I didn't even think about, like, GI people because, like, Dan doesn't have kids, but he's like quite a bit older than me, you know.
Yeah.
Dan Riker, so it's like that doesn't register. And Ben only recently had a kid, so it's like There's only one friend where I'm like, oh, he's old. That's an old guy, ancient crypt keeper.
I also think Ben Hansen looks very young.
That's
like
true.
he was on there was a very entertaining Min-Max thing they did recently where he was voted like funniest boy in his class. And he recently called the girl in his high school class who was voted funniest girl. And they just, like, had a conversation.
Was it funny?
It was really... She was very funny. She's, like, not a podcaster. But was, like... I was, like, I see it. I get why. But anyway, it was, like, oh, yeah. He is... I guess he's, like, the oldest millennial, probably.
I guess so.
Actually,
yeah.
He might be just middle. Because we're, like, right at the bottom. Technically... We could be you know, Gen Z.
What do you consider yourself?
I consider myself a millennial because when I was growing up and I was reading people complaining about my generation, they said millennials. And so that is what I took my definition from. But like, my sister is 4 years younger than me, and she's like firmly Gen Z.
Wait, so what are we deciding between Gen X and millennial is what we are? Or Gen Z and millennial?
No, we are almost with the younger people.
Oh, okay. But I definitely consider myself, I guess, a millennial because I'm so not as like internet savvy as like a Gen Zer. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, it's like, I think the oldest millennial was born like 86, 87, maybe.
Oh, that makes sense.
So it's like the oldest ones are like in their 40s.
Yeah.
That would be 84.
Here's something I hate, and I'm curious your perspective as someone a little younger than me.
Yeah.
Like, people my age love to be like, I'm a 90s kid. And it's like, no, we're fucking not. I was like,
right.
40.
Yeah, it's like, I had consciousness for like 6 months of the 90s.
Yeah, I was 5 when the 90s ended. I'm a 2000s kid, but I hate, like, people are like, oh, I miss the 90s. I was like, what, the 2 months you had fucking thought?
I miss shitting in diapers. I miss when someone fed me my food like it was a little airplane.
Yeah, well, when you put it that way, I do kind of miss just shit in my pants. Now I have to get up, go to the toilet. So obnoxious.
Hey, you got 50 more years. You can be there again.
Great. Can't wait. You want to answer some fucking questions?
Yeah, but you've got a note first.
Oh, yeah. So I was, as I do once a month, I was going through all our lovely emails, and I noticed there were many about the SR, something wrong, codename SR, you know, our internal name for this project, SR, about the merch drop, which has sold out. We have said we are not doing any more. We don't have many opportunities to kind of address the nation, as it were, the SR nation.
But that's what we're doing right now.
But that's what we're doing. So without saying anything too concrete, for anyone who has reached out about those in the last few months, I'm sorry. The Silent Hill 3 shirt with Heather is not coming back. They're done. We're not doing any more reprints of them. However, I will say that does not, by any stretch of the imagination, mean that will be the only or last Something Rotten merch. It can't be, Jacob, because I had to sign up for a $15 a month Big Cartel premium package for us.
That's right. We got to make that worth it.
Yeah. So stay tuned in the future. But unfortunately, for anyone who missed the Silent Hill shirts, they're not coming back for you.
That being said, if you did buy them, I have loved the people tagging us on social media with them. It's really fun. Several comments being like, I did not expect how good this shirt would be quality wise. On Saturday, both Annie and I wore ours separate from each other. Like, we did not be like, we're gonna be twinning today. But they're just nice shirts. Like, it's actually a good, you know, addition to my wardrobe.
Here's the thing I want to say, and this is a slight call out of other podcasts, if I may, Jacob, but it comes from a place of love. Other podcasts, especially ones that are bigger than us, make more money. Don't go to these Redbubbles or Teesprings. Invest in your merch.
Yeah.
Your listeners will really appreciate it. I've bought other merch from other content creators that deteriorates after the first wash. Like, don't go to those.
Yeah, I got a Doughboy shirt that is falling apart.
Do not do that. It is worth the investment. And also, if you're smart, consider how much you invest in the shirts and reflect that in how much you charge for the shirts. It's worth it. My heart has been full hearing people be like really impressed with the quality of those things, because we work to go with people we trusted. So come on, podcasts, pick it up. First question.
But is it rotten though? From Garrett.
Yeah, we got a lot of questions about when we announced MGS, whether or not they're rotten games.
Yeah, a similar question from Perry. Something I'm missing from the pod as of late is the discussion regarding qualification of selected games as rotten. Sometimes, duh, X game is rotten, but hearing a discussion about the elements that make it rotten is always a good time. Why do the selected games belong in the rotten canon? On Minmax, Jacob said y'all are playing Metal Gear Solid 1 and 2, Ben Hansen seemed shocked, and Jacob said they're politically rotten. I'd love to hear that divulged on.
I think, Jacob, there are like two different sides to the answer here. There's one, are the MGS games rotten? Two, I'm sure we've talked about it a little, but I feel like over time, we've slowly expanded what games we're willing to cover.
Right.
You know, so that we didn't inevitably have to do like Postal and Hatred in season mm-hmm. 5. So I think we have to address both topics.
Right. And I think that Perry is right and that like this should be something that we talk about on the mainline sure. episodes. Like here is the rottenness of it. And sometimes I think we usually end up talking about it, you know, but maybe not defining like here's why it's rotten. This is why this is for me. How rotten did you feel the Metal Gear Solid games were? Because this is probably our biggest kind of step outside our established definition sure. thus far.
I think MGS1, if I'm just like thinking about it in broad strokes, maybe not the most rotten thing in the world. MGS2's worldview, like the way that game ends, like and how like bleak it feels, is rotten to me. Where it's like, there's just this AI that is going to dictate, you know, it's like a thought control process. And you are going to lose free will because there's this primordial ooze in the White House that has just like decided it's going to consume the brains of every human being over time. it does end. It ends being like, but you know, do you like playing piano? Just live, brother. I was like, well, no. You've also painted this incredibly, like, nihilistic, terrifying view of the future of our planet in a way yes. that I find very rotten.
And I think specifically the Metal Gear Solid 2 explanation, which we talked about so much on the episode, which is, like, not only is there an evil AI, but the AI is evil because the United States as a construction is so fucked up that it like yep. created a new life form whose purpose is to be evil. Like that is what it is. And so it's like, yeah, that is such a kind of like cynical viewpoint in this really beautiful poetic way that like that definitely qualifies. I think, you know, actually George Super Bunny Hop on our first episode brought up the rottenness of Metal Gear Solid 1, which is just kind of like
playing it
every you know, that was we who brought that up. Him kind of saying that like every soldier in that game is being treated as completely disposable. You know, all the people that are there are just there to die by this mysterious disease, and Snake is being sent in without any like expectation that he needs to know the things he's fighting for and all of this. And so it's not necessarily rotten in the way that, you know, like when Max Payne talks, you're like, this guy wants to kill himself all the time. Yeah, that makes him feel rotten. You don't really get that feeling from Snake, but it is like a kind of cruel world feeling that I think does kind of permeate the political consciousness of those games.
We got a lot of emails that I don't think I included any, so just for the sake of bringing them up, we got a lot of emails about the more rotten MGS games. I think Ground Zeroes and Peace Walker came up quite a bit. And I think, not immediately, but I think a Ground Zeroes short season, maybe this December or something, like how we did a really short season last year, maybe worth revisiting. Because I played that game and I remember it being rotten. At least the vagina bomb. Very rotten.
Yeah, well, that's rotten in that it has, like, very specific cruel violence against women, which yeah. is, you know, a qualification of a rotten game.
On the other hand, though, Vagina Bomb is my new feminist punk yep. band.
Our friend AJ Moser has been telling us that 3 actually has maybe more overtly rotten themes, and I will say, I don't want to play the remake of 3 without having first played the original, so, like, I'm definitely going to play it at some point. It feels like if we're both going to play it, why not cover it?
I think a 3 and 3 remake season would be cool. I think we've talked about this privately a few times. I think that would be a fun concept.
We've talked about it. The problem is that they've said we don't know enough about what the remake is to make this call. It seems like they are going to be so faithful that it would be kind of uninteresting. That every time we'd just be like, well, the graphics are better, but I don't know, does it make the game worse? Like, we'd just be saying that for like 3 episodes.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, you ready? This is a comment from Brendan that might be one of the proudest moments of my life. I mean this unironically. I mean it with all sincerity. Brendan says, Thanks for the great show. You both have wonderful insight, and this is such a compelling concept for a podcast. Thank you, Brendan. here's to many more seasons. Lastly, I am a new manager of an independent video store in Toronto, and Something Rotten has convinced me to give Kenji Fukasaku a section in our director's aisle. His films go too hard, smoke too tough, etc., for me to justify not having him there. Thanks for inspiring me to fill that hole. That's so cool. And for listeners, especially any Toronto listeners or travelers to Toronto, that's Bay Street Video in Toronto. So you can find them on Twitter at Bay Street Video. So shouts out. That's so cool. That's so cool. I feel if that's the ways in which I'm an influencer, by God, I wear it proudly on my sleeve.
All right. Devesh. Says, my favorite bit in Metal Gear Solid 2 is the reveal that the Patriots are not an AI, but rather the living manifestation of American ideology. Me too. Metal Gear Solid 4 immediately retcons this to make them AIs you can kill again, which makes sense in a literally how would we follow that up way, but is to me still disappointing. If you had to design a game where the villain is pure ideology and you were 100% free to do whatever you want in terms of scope or genre, what would you want to make? I think I would probably make a game I'm tentatively calling Rez But Evil.
Now, counterpoint, I would argue in Rez, you are evil.
Yeah.
Rez, secretly, a rotten game. We should play it. I have no clue. This one stumped me. Do you have anything?
I think the villain of the game we're playing next season is kind of ideology.
Sure.
But in a way that is... You know, it is essentially, like, what horrors lurk in man's soul versus, like, fascism is the controlling principle of the United States, which is, like, what MGS2 is doing.
Yeah.
This is why, like, media that grapples with institutional forces is so often boiled down to, like, and there's one guy in control of it and you can shoot him. Because, like, if you don't have that, what the fuck do you do?
Yeah.
There are a number of games, like, indie games that have come out over the past couple years that are kind of centered around, like, unraveling conspiracies.
Mm.
I can't think of their names right now, but it's, like, I'm sure you could kind of find them, like... They're including, like, connecting things with red string kind of, like, oh, it's all whatever. And so I think you could do this kind of commentary on a government or something where you have the theme of the game be corruption. And it turns out that it's not just a few bad apples. It is everyone that's kind of in on this large scale conspiracy, which would be interesting, but it makes the gameplay of the game kind of reading files, which is why Rez But Evil is a great idea, because it's like you can still have kind of a game there, and it's really hard to think of what the game would be if the villain is ideology.
I think there's fertile ground in the genre of playing a computer virus. You know, Rez is a prime example. Parts of Nier Automata.
Sure.
I think I would make a game where you play a physical manifestation of a computer virus and you're bringing down some big bad govo. That would be it. Kind of like Anonymous. They're not virus people, right? They're just leakers.
They're just hackers. Well, they might use viruses. I don't know. This is something that's always freaked me out. You know, like viruses that you can get as a person. Isn't it bizarre that they are not living organisms? That, like, you know, there's kind of, like, if you, like, swallow, you know, mold or whatever, you can kind of get sick because there are, like, bad cells in there and they will get your cells sick. But viruses are, like, I don't know. I'm sure there's an actual biological answer that would totally make sense to me. But it's, like, they look like little creatures. They look like little robots that you fight, but they're, like, not alive. And so it's, like, what are they doing? Why are they going in here and making me sick?
Yeah. You're having a really you're having an existentialist breakdown about it.
It's I like mushrooms freak me out for similar reasons.
That's fair. How are sperm not little live guys?
Yeah, just like a bunch of little Blakes in there.
How do they swim around? Like, I don't understand. Like, they are alive, but they're not living creatures, but they can die? Do you know what I'm saying?
I do. And you know, I guess we have no choice but to believe in God because we don't understand human anatomy.
I believe in sperm, at least. Okay, so this comes from Luke. Nowadays, I find MGS2 just as profound as I did when I was younger, but the more I replay it, the less I latch onto those elements people frequently dub as political or predictive. Instead, I find myself more enthralled with Raiden, with Emma, with the individualist motivations and messages of the game. As a survivor of childhood trauma, there's so much that resonates with me about MGS2 that I ignored in favor of all the sci-fi junk like everyone else when I first played it. A few that come to mind are details like Emma stating her goal in working on Arsenal was to hurt Otacon, how Raiden wades back into war operations despite war trauma that he clearly wants to forget, and so on. If we go a bit further with this, a similar thing happened to me with this game. Rather than reflect on myself as an individual the way the game wanted me to, I rejected that and spent the years after holding it up as some sort of ideological symbol. It wasn't until much later when replaying it that I found more of a personal connection and broke free from all the messy violence and politics to instead find solace in its more uplifting message. So my question I ask is mainly, do you think MGS is political, or is it just a political backdrop for a game that is meant to mirror our own beliefs? Beyond that, do you feel that MGS2 makes a good commentary on how individuals struggle with childhood trauma?
The personal is political, baby.
Yeah. Like, that's... You are your politics. And your politics are you.
I think it is... It is, you know, hard to hold on to because so much of our politics happen on a national stage and are abstracted and whatever. But it's like, politics are what affect you, you know? And, like... Like, I love... The most interesting thing about Otacon's character is, like, he doesn't want to be creating war machines, but he is. And it's like, that is the politics that every person who works in tech has to wrestle with. You know, like, if you are making a spreadsheet tool, at some point, the U.S. military is going to use that spreadsheet tool to, like, make missiles that kill people, you know? And it's like, suddenly whatever you're doing in your personal life is going to interact with politics in a huge way. And so I think that, Luke, you make a great point in kind of, I think, maturing in your understanding of politics is not just seeing them as kind of a web of high-level conspiracies, but like understanding how decisions that people high up make affect you and your life, and how they have affected them for generations, and how potentially, you know, any trauma that you could have experienced as a child was not just because you had, you know, an unlucky childhood, but because, like, structural conditions enabled, like, the situation that created that trauma or whatever. I'm not saying that if we had a perfect welfare state, no one would ever experience trauma, but, like, you know, typically when you're looking at a problem, the end answer is not just people are awful. There is something structural going on.
It's really interesting, I think, as I've gotten older and the world has gotten worse, and also I moved to the greatest dystopia on earth, baby, New York City. The way you often will have to fight your own personal politics with the realities of structures and systems. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but go on.
I'm dealing with a situation that I probably shouldn't divulge that runs up against my political beliefs, but I have to kind of, there are certain percentages of me that have to work against them because of the systems at play, which has become like it's honestly very like a soul-sucking, like, ethical dilemma where I'm having to like rely on systems I don't believe in. And I've never really been confronted with situations like that where, like, my personal sense of being is, like, so reliant on systems I don't believe in.
Right.
That, like, has created a real moral quandary of self for me in a way where it's, like, my politics and my morals are, like, inseparable at this point. But also I'm having to, like, fight with them. I'm being intentionally vague. But, you know, it's, like, it is one of those weird things where it's, like, fuck. The world sucks. Sometimes you have to go against your own belief systems because you have no other choice.
Yeah. And it, you know, it is like in those situations, it is really important to kind of be thinking like, why do I believe the things that I believe?
Yeah.
What is the way in which I wish this situation could be resolved? You know, like there are things where it's like, you're gonna run into problems. The shit of like, hey, man, I had my car stolen, and I hate the cops, but, like, what am I supposed to do? You know, like, it's a real situation that people are going to run into. And so it's, I think, returning to this question, Metal Gear Solid is absolutely political. And I do believe that it has a perspective as opposed to being just a mirror for your own beliefs. But I do think that the power of its political position is that it's not a textbook, you know, that it shows how its politics are affecting individual people, and that's what makes it compelling. Speaking of which, we had our friend Julie Muncy on the show many months ago to talk about The Last of Us 2. Julie has, I don't know if it's because of us or just randomly, been playing a string of rotten games where she played Metal Gear Solid 2 at about the same time as us, and she's now playing Max Payne 3 and has been tweeting her way through it, which I've really enjoyed seeing. But I wrote to her when we were wrapping up Metal Gear Solid 2 to see if she had any kind of, like, takeaway thoughts that would fit well with something rotten, and this is what she responded with. She said, gosh, I have roughly a book's worth of thoughts. But one thing that stuck out to me finishing it this time is the exchange between Snake and Raiden, where Raiden says of the Patriots, they taught me some good stuff too. And Snake just says, knowingly, kind of sad, I know. There's a real insight there into the way that you, when you're excavating your identity from structural or social or interpersonal violence, have to sift through all the lessons it taught you, the experiences you had, and try to understand and disregard the bad while also acknowledging and finding ways to own and make sense of the good. It's an ugly insight, right? Like, it's so much easier to think that only bad comes from bad experiences, that there is nothing beautiful to try and excavate and clean up and take with you. The idea that there's both, because that's how experience works on a fundamental level, is way harder and in a way much crueler. Good shit, Julie. Turns out good writer.
Yeah, that was a way better way to say what I tried to say in like 10 minutes. Julie had it in like 100 words. That was great.
Damon asks, listening to your Last of Us 2 episodes, it kind of reminded me of how, I guess, gore focused a lot of the AAA spaces now, and how gore and ultraviolence are now flagship features of games. I want to know if you guys think there's a place for a new Kane and Lynch 2-style game. I think with games like that one indie body cam game, and admittedly a bad reference point, Ready or Not, that with the
installed,
right
Jacob.
Ideas, that with the right ideas and team, there's something that could be made. Sorry for the long question. All my love. I hope you had a happy holiday and new year. Damon, it's not a long question.
We've certainly talked about this before, but it was years and years and years ago, so I thought it would be fun to talk about it again. I believe our idea back in the day was, which granted, I don't know if this would be outdated at this point, but like something that was filmed with vertical cell phone cam, like that look. How you see, like, World Star fight videos.
Uh-huh.
You know what I'm saying? Like, I think, like, we had talked about that kind of idea. Maybe I'm trying to remember, but I still stand by this idea. Like, the way that, like, Kane and Lynch on 2 on the surface has the worst camera in video game history. It's like, how can we make that worse? And be like, you would mimic a cell phone cam filming vertically.
Yeah, well, a lot of the trailer for GTA 6... That recently came out. Is like shot on phone cameras.
I don't know if there is room for Kane and Lynch 3, mostly because Kane and Lynch 2 is so reviled, except by geniuses of the world.
Yeah, it's like there wasn't really room for Kane and Lynch 2. They just made it anyway.
Yeah. I think that's a one and done, because I can't remember where Rasmus Paulsen, who was the creative director, was like, people hated us for Kane and Lynch 1 so much because of the Jeff Gerstmann thing that we're like, fuck it. We're damned if we do, we're damned if we don't. Let's just make the kind of game we want to make. So, like, IO's not going to do that again. People love them. There's no reason for them to make something that gnarly. They're going to make a James Bond game. Also, they don't own the Kane and Lynch property. Like, I think that was a perfect confluence of events that led a big scale developer to be like, we're gonna create an anti-art game that I like at this point in the industry. Naughty Dog or whoever is not gonna make that. Maybe the indie space.
I mean, I think, you know, I think that Unrecord, the body cam game, currently that looks pretty close. The question on everyone's mind is like, how propaganda is that game going to be?
Mm-hmm.
But aesthetically, it's pretty fucking close to Caden yeah. Lynch 2's level of kind of off-puttingness. I think that something that we've talked about on this show before is like the what being kind of a bigger budget game can lend to something that yes. there is a level of rotten that can kind of only be achieved if you have enough money to like invest in shit where it's like if you are limited in terms of your world design or your fucking gore system or anything, mm-hmm. you might not kind of reach the same level of like overwhelming rotten feeling.
I don't think we'll ever get another Caden Lynch 2 in the AAA space, which even though that game is aged pretty poorly, like it still feels like a AAA game in a way that like Unrecord, at least based on what we've seen, feels like a game made by one person that looks very impressive. Sure. Nonetheless, I think Caden Lynch 2 is just one and done, honestly. And I think that's unfortunate, but so it goes.
Yeah, we'll see. But it's like, we won't get another Caden Lynch 2, but we'll get other stuff. I mean, I don't think we're going to get another The Last of Us 2, but like, we'll get other stuff that will be interesting, even if they make The Last of Us 3. I don't think it'll be as nasty.
Yeah. This comes from Luca. I recently had a lot of fun with a great game by a well-known Japanese game designer. It was about how nuclear weapons are bad, all women are the same, and all characters in it have dumb names. You must have figured out by now that I am obviously talking about Killer 7.
Yes!
Mr. Hester's constant mentioning of how good that game is made me want to check it out. And what do you know? It was very good. So thanks for that. My pleasure. I also watched a playthrough of MGS and am delighted to play through MGS2 in the following weeks. So I haven't yet listened to the MGS2 episodes. That being said, I still have a question for you. If you guys were in a Kojima game, what would your silly Kojima character names be? Warm regards from Croatia, and very much looking forward to future episodes.
Okay, so let's talk about Kojima names, because there's like the Death Stranding style, which is present in Metal Gear Solid as well, but sure. That's the kind of like diehard man or whatever. But there's also like kind of the Liquid Ocelot style, and then there's like Sam Porter Bridges, which are all different styles of stupid names.
I'm gonna go the Death Stranding style, supporting cast, and my name would be Blake Dumbass Boy, because I'm a boy who's a dumbass. But he spelled a little differently. It'd be like Dumas, but it'd be like Blake Dumas Boy, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
it would be me.
I'm trying to think if Kojima would like, I feel like it would be like so in Hebrew Jacob is Yaakov. That is like my Hebrew name, so yeah, it would be like Jacob Yaakov Beard. I feel like that would be where it'd be like, here's his two things. He's Jewish and he has a beard.
The other night, I was staying with my partner and we woke up the next morning and she was like, were you speaking really good Hebrew last night? And I was like, no, darling. You were dreaming I could speak Hebrew. But she was like, you were saying all those Hebrew words. I was like, no, I absolutely was not doing
that. Do you think you were just snoring and you were kind of inadvertently going like, Hanukkah.
Hey, that's not a joke I can make. It's not a joke I can participate in. No, but she snores like crazy. That's a call out. Sam, I know you're listening. We gotta get you a CPAP machine or something. All right. Go for it.
Blake asked if Metal Gear Solid 2 is supposed to have an antagonistic relationship with the player. For my two cents, I think it is. This is an idea I've been thinking about writing about, but I have a couple other ideas as well as college classes that have taken priority first. I think that Metal Gear Solid 2 outright hates the player. The end of the game throws so many plot twists at the player that are so hard to follow that the player is mentally exhausted. The player is also physically exhausted by the end, having fought 20 Metal Gears and lived through a minute button mashing sequence in the original release on the hardest difficulty. Another reason I think Metal Gear Solid 2 hates the player is because of something I never noticed until Leadhead pointed out in her video, The Most Interesting Game Ever Made. The game is lying to the player at the end, making up quotes that Emma and the president supposedly said but never did. To me, Metal Gear Solid 2 falls into a very narrow genre of art that hates the person who consumes it. I was originally writing out my thoughts on other examples of the genre before realizing this wasn't the place for that. Instead, I will say the other biggest staple of the genre to me is Satoshi Kon's Perfect Blue. From Ash.
You ever seen Perfect Blue?
Nope.
Great movie. I got Paranoia Agent sitting right next to me right now. Kon, the greatest who ever did it. I think it's really interesting. I think MGS2 does hate the player in a way that I really admire. I I think the idea about the plot twists are meant to exhaust you mentally is really interesting. I don't know if I believe it, but I do agree maybe with the physical exhaustion of the MG, the like Metal Gear fights.
Yeah.
How do you feel about it?
First off, I don't think art that hates the consumer is actually that rare. There are certainly, if you search video games that hate the player, even on YouTube, you'll get a lot of results for that. And I think there are so many kind of
Kane and Lynch too
books and movies. Yeah, Kane and Lynch too. You know, something like Eraserhead or fucking like Finnegan's Wake or any of these famously kind of like hostile to consumption pieces of art would fit the bill. I don't actually think that Metal Gear Solid 2 does. I think that the mechanics of the game are too kind of fun and interesting for it. It's like Metal Gear Solid 2 has so many little interactions where it's like, oh, you can leave the porn magazine on the ground and the guard will look at the porn magazine, or like, oh, you can shoot a radio out of the guard's hands while they're calling into the radio, that are just like such fun game designy things that I don't think the game as a whole comes across that antagonistically, because it's so clearly like having fun with itself and it wants you to have fun with it. It wants you to, you know, shoot the ice bucket and watch the ice melt and do all that. But I do think that it wants the player to feel very challenged by it and upset expectations and kind of leave them feeling somewhat dizzy. So it's like, I agree that it's definitely, it's not trying to go down smooth, but I don't know if that's the same as hating the player.
What do you, you got any things you like that hate the viewer, reader, or watch, player?
I mean, my classic example, which I wrote about this years ago, is the video game Naissance, which is kind of hostile mm-hmm. architecture one, which is very, you know, very, I think, I haven't played it. I think people talk about Lisa the Painful this way. What's that game that Eyepatch Wolf
Hunger?
Likes? Fear and Hunger.
Fear and Hunger, yeah.
Another example that feels similar. It's like, there are a lot of games that are, I think, just mechanically hostile enough that people talk about them as hating the player.
I got a movie I always think about in regards to this, but I'm going to save it for the answer to another question in a few minutes.
Cool.
Greetings from the UK. This comes from Rick. Cheerio. Hope the weather is not too rainy over there. Yes. Hope you're enjoying your toast and beans. After watching Jacob's work on YouTube for years, I finally signed up to Nebula. I got a question about this next comment here. Expecting that Soma playthrough from Blake now. Did we say we were going to? Did I say I was going to do that?
I do not remember, but I assume you did.
Rick or someone, please write to our email, somethingrottenpodcast@gmail.com, and remind me what that is, because Rick's saying they signed up. And I have to do it, so remind me why I have to do it. I'm working my way through the podcast and currently up to The Last of Us Part 2. I admit I've not played most of the games on your list. Darkness 2, Crew, represent, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But I'm interested in hearing if the two of you have had any experiences with nightmares, restlessness, or bad sleep as a result of playing these games. I remember distinctly playing the demo for Carmageddon 2 in the late 90s. Carmageddon, was that Remedy's game before? No, I don't think so. I think that was Death Rally. Anyway, in the late 90s as a young teenager, and how much it seemed to disturb my subconscious for a while by being related to something that was so important to me, cars, as well as a lifestyle choice in general, driving. As I've got older, these things seem to affect me less. These days, Stalker and various mods is probably the most rotten game I play, but I was just looking to hear your thoughts about if any of these games have had a relatively substantial impact on your downtime after playing them, especially after you choose a game and completely mainline it to hit targets. Cheers, lads, and keep up the work. Good work.
Thank you, Rick. The most a game has affected my sleep is Anatomy, where the first time I played it, I like really had a hard time. I considered sleeping with the lights on.
Wow.
You know, like I was freaked out by the concept of being in my bedroom, which is what that game is trying to do. Presently, I don't think it's happened with any rotten games that we've done.
Yeah.
Weirdly, I get more affected by mechanics in terms of sleep, where it's like, I remember there are certain games that I've like played for long enough and are kind of mechanically it's like they get your brain into such a specific way of thinking that then I can't shut that off. I think actually with Marvel's Midnight Suns, the Firaxis game, I was like, I played that for so long. I would like shut my eyes and I would still be thinking about like pushing people into other people.
Yeah.
And it was like I was going to sleep and I'd still kind of be like groggily playing Midnight Suns in my brain.
I used to make to-do lists when I was playing Death Stranding for the first time and I was done playing. I would make to-do lists in my notes app of like what I wanted to do the next day and what deliveries I wanted to do and how I should route them. Have I ever talked about how I wish I had more nightmares?
I don't think you have.
This is like something I think about pretty frequently. Because I've watched so many fucking horror movies in my day, I just like I rarely get like very, very scared from media anymore. Anatomy really fucked me up, but I don't live in a suburban home. I live in a very densely populated part of New York City. So I was like, well, when I turn the game off, it's not going to affect me that much. But I really wish things would give me more nightmares, not like. Like spooky, scary nightmares, like, oh, the boogeyman's in my dreams or something like that. Because, like, I miss the sensation of being very scared. Because, like, even when I watch a horror movie and I'm like, damn, that shit rocks. It was real spooky. It, like, never affects me after the movie's over, you know? So I wish.
Yeah.
I wish some of these rotten games would affect me more and I could have spooky dreams and wake up all scared because I kind of miss that feeling, which is why I probably need to go back to therapy.
This is slightly off topic, but I read this book last year called Breathe or Breath, which is this whole it's kind of a self-help book, but it's all about breathing, and it's basically all about how like we fucked ourselves up by mouth breathing and not nose breathing and all these other things that like your breathing affects so many things, blah blah blah. There's this story about a woman who was born without, or it's like she had a small, the part of her brain that made her feel fear, where essentially she just never experienced at all. And like, you know, would kind of like, oh, we're putting a spider on your hand. And she like wouldn't react and like didn't feel anything. And he wrote about, there was this test where they had her take basically a big gulp of pure carbon dioxide, which essentially makes your brain immediately feel like it's drowning because there's like no oxygen in it. And in the test, it was like she freaked the fuck out and would not do it again. They were like, hey, can we want to like replicate those results? And she's like, I'm not fucking doing that again.
Wow.
Because it was like it like activated a different part of the fear center, or like it was like scared in a different part of her brain. So she actually felt it as opposed to all the other times when she was supposed to be scared and didn't. And I think about that a lot. It's like she was scared in a whole new way.
Wow. That's really interesting. What's that book called?
It's called Breathe. It's a popular one. I feel like there's probably a healthy amount of pseudoscience in that book, but it's still an interesting read.
You live in a big old house now.
Yep.
Big YouTube content house with.
That's right. I live with a bunch of other content people.
You ever get scared in there? You watch any movies recently that spook you out?
I don't have to watch movies to feel scared. I mean, it's like, I have lived mostly in houses for the past several years of my life, and it's like being in a house alone with most of the lights out is scary. Just full stop. You know, it's like I don't need to watch a movie to feel scared, though. If I do, I will feel extra scared afterwards.
Well, yeah. What was the last movie that really scared you, though?
Oh gosh, I don't know. I can't. It's like because it's like I've watched movies that I was tense during them,
right?
But was not scared afterwards. I'm going to have to come back to you on that. I can't remember the last movie I watched that I was scared.
I remember mine. It was, I think, 2020. So it's been a few years. It was the we talked about this.
Everybody's Gone to the World's Fair.
No, that movie scared me while I was watching it, but not after.
Okay.
That's the important distinction. It was, we talked about this movie on the podcast before, The Last of Us bonus pod, the French film Inside. There is a scene where a person just shows up in a window, and I was watching it at my parents' late at night in their basement, and they have like a very similar door and window setup, and behind their house is like nothing, so it was just pitch black down there. And I had to pause. This happens in the first 20 minutes of the fucking movie. I had to pause it and like take like a half an hour break. I got so fucking scared. And then after I turned the movie off, I had to walk past those fucking doors so many times. I was petrified, dude.
Here is the scariest thing that is in my brain that I worry about every single night is I just look out a window and there's like someone there.
Yeah.
And that's like, that's it. That's the scariest idea.
No longer a problem for me. I live on the sixth floor. So
that would be even scarier if you did see someone.
That's true, actually.
Clancy writes, a recurring theme that I noticed throughout a number of Rotten games is being cinematic or trying to be more like a movie. Kane and Lynch 2's camera being diegetic and trying to emulate Live Leak, the entirety of Manhunt being framed as a snuff film, The Last of Us being adapted into a miniseries to critical acclaim, and now Metal Gear Solid. With all the video game movie adaptations and the stereotypical Sony movie game being more prevalent than ever, it is interesting to look back on MGS1, where Kojima states that cinema was his biggest influence. However, this begs the question, why are games trying to be more like movies when they could be so much more? Mm-hmm. The ending of Metal Gear Solid 2 is a personal favorite example of a story that could only be told through the lens of a video game. Since comparing games to movies is a recurring talking point on the podcast, with Blake going as far to say the best video games are mid-movies, I wanted to ask what you guys think about cinematic games. What lessons should game developers take from film directors and cinema?
I think the issue with cinematic games is that it exposes that in some creators' heads, their greatest aspirations are that games can only be films and not something mm-hmm. different or more interesting. I'm not going to say better because that's a winless conversation there. But like, I think Last of Us Part 2, for example, one of these big cinematic games, earns its interactivity more than a game like Last of Us 1. Which does really interesting things with the Ellie Joel dynamic. But, like, it made a lot more sense to me that Last of Us 1 could be an HBO show than Last of Us 2. Because I'm like, how do you make Abby work in a way that isn't interactive without making Abby, a Last of Us 2, like, four seasons long, right?
Yeah, and it also, it seems like the focus that is put on kind of game development is, like, the graphics are so good, the motion capture is so good, the lighting is so good, all of these things that will essentially make it look more like a movie mm-hmm. and less so on, again, something that I think The Last of Us 2 did really well, like AI or, yeah. you know, something that not AI like fucking ChatGPT, but enemies walking around yeah. behaving realistically. You know, seeming like they're really there. This is what everyone says with next gen is like, I wish the systems got more advanced rather than the things. But I think because it's harder to show off systems and also because I think people do really just like those playable movies. We have kind of gone in the direction of like, wow, look at how much better the graphics are now.
Right. Yeah. And so I think like that's the issue with them is like their greatest aspirations are to only to be comparable to film rather than to be like pinnacles of their own medium. You know mm-hmm. what I'm saying? And it's why my favorite cinematic moments in games are often things that would be impossible to film practically in a movie, setting aside CG and everything. But like the intro to Devil May Cry 5. Where they're showing like the names of the developers while Nero is like flipping outside the bus and everything. It's like, that's not something you could actually go and film. And that's why I think it's like really interesting because it's like, oh, this only works in like a digital space.
Oh, sure. But like they could, like that's similar to something that they do in like Spider-Verse or whatever. Like you're just talking about kind of creative animation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But like, I don't know. Like there's no practical... There's no practical filmmaking in games, so it's like, I understand you could do that with CG and everything, but like, when God of War is like, oh look, it looks like the camera guy's behind him and it's a single take, I'm like, I don't give a shit, but when it does something like really cool with its camera, like, I am more compelled by it. Does that make sense?
It does. I think it's, you know, I think that's basically just talking about compelling filmmaking, which I think, honestly, is a problem where it's like, games want to be movies, but in kind of a boring way, where I always go back to, it's like, if you look at the way that the cutscenes in Wolfenstein The New Order are directed, they are from a cinematography perspective, way more interesting than the stuff that most Sony AAA games are doing right now, because their prestige camera work is often just not very interesting, and I feel like is not... is not like framing shots in the most interesting way. And so part of the problem with cinematic games is that they're not actually that good at like being movies. You know, they're not doing, it's like when we talk about like how good Spielberg is at like putting a camera somewhere and putting lights somewhere. Right. It's like we're not getting that out of the prestige AAA games yet. It's just kind of that they think if they have really good looking characters and good lighting systems that the game will automatically right. be interesting from a cinema perspective.
Not much thought put into like blocking and how the actual frame tells the story as much as the script.
And it's like, I'm sure there is, you know, I'm sure that they are, the people who are doing this are thinking about framing and whatever, but it feels almost more like their house style is limiting them, that they don't want to be too out, they don't want the camera to ever draw attention to itself, you know?
You know what game had beautiful cutscenes? Kin: A Bridge of Spirits, because they were a film studio before they were a game studio. That game's not that great, but the cutscenes were incredible. Also, I'm ready to have this conversation. I don't think cutscenes at 60 frames a second look cinematic, no matter what you do. And now all these games, they have their performance mode. You want to play them, but then the cutscenes are 60 frames a second. They just fucking look garbage. Just knock the cutscenes down to 24 frames a second. You've solved half your fucking problem.
Wait, so, okay. Because I'm currently playing a game that is there are pre-rendered cutscenes, and like the pre-rendered cutscenes do run at a lower frame rate than the game, and it is noticeable. Okay,
and that's good. Run them at 24 frames a second, like something like Spider-Man. I want to play in performance mode because shit's so fast, but then the cutscenes are in 60 frames a second. I'm like, this looks like a fucking soap opera.
I don't know if I agree with that.
That's fine. You can be wrong. I don't care if you're wrong.
I do think there is something that we kind of, that doesn't often get talked about with this, which is I feel like there is, when we're talking about cinematic games, we're talking about like cutscenes, and then it feels like the cutscenes are trying to be like movies, and what we really want to be talking about is gameplay. But I think that like the cutscene, you know, I'm thinking about in the original Final Fantasy VII, Sephiroth kills Aerith. You know, big moment happens in a cutscene. There is nothing that you can do to affect that cutscene. But the reason that moment hits is because Aerith is a party member that you, like, invested a bunch of gameplay time in. And, like, that is something that a movie can't do. It can't make you, like, actually put resources into a character and then kill them. And so it's like, the game's big moments can still be in cutscenes. I don't think that it has to be entirely in gameplay. But, like, you know, much like Metal Gear Solid 2. Metal Gear Solid 2 is a fucking ton of cutscenes. But, like, it's doing stuff interesting enough with its game that then those cutscenes kind of work in interaction with them.
I do really think we're talking a lot about Sony first-party games right here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think something those games do that is really good cinematically is often how they will stage the introduction of a level. Like, we talked about Ellie getting out of the water in Seattle and seeing the aquarium. Like, how yeah. it's framed. Like, and you're playing that. Like, they have set up that that's how you will enter that area. Another one I think about is in the God of War 2018, the, like, snowy area where the dead giant is collapsed, and that's the beginning of the level.
Oh, yeah,
you
that's
start
it.
There, and the head is down there. Like, I think all that shit is really great and such a cool way to, like, bridge what you're playing with, like, how it looks cinematically. But the cutscenes in a lot of these games don't do much for me.
Yeah, there was one fine.
There was like one really cool like long shot in Last of Us Part Two that I thought was pretty neat, but nevertheless, so it goes. Put your cutscenes in 24 frames a second, put the fucking black bars on there, just let them make another Order 1886, man. Come on. What are we fucking doing here? Anyway, hey guys, this comes from Julian. Hey guys, I appreciate the podcast a ton. It's really interesting seeing unique perspectives on video games I grew up on. How can you see us, Julian? Maybe someone is outside my sixth floor window. As well as video games I recently gotten into. Question. Considering the meta and postmodernist themes throughout the Metal Gear franchise, what are y'all's personal favorite uses of this in other games, movies, etc., i.e. a show, a book, or a movie that exhibits self-awareness, breaking the fourth wall, commentary on the ideals and expectations of the audience in a compelling way?
I bet we have the same first answer.
I bet we don't.
Not Nier Automata?
Nope.
Okay, well, Nier Automata.
Hell yeah. The Michael Haneke film, Funny Games, cliche answer, but I think what that does... to fuck with you as the viewer of the film is so interesting. Without spoiling it, there is a scene involving a TV remote and the expectations of happy endings. And I think it is so cool. And the more that film breaks and winks and nods at you, I think it's really rad. But speak on Nier. Speak on Nier, brother.
I've only played through Nier Automata once. And so it's kind of, you know, I just remember the like big moments of like that final ending, like the choice that it asks you to make at the ending is kind of like, do you want to make a player logic decision or like a game logic decision? And understanding those as like two separate things, which is really cool. You know, I think using the structure of just having a bunch of endings, it's like that does not make sense if you're only viewing the story as through the perspective of the characters. Like, it has to be understood as you, a player, playing through them as opposed to like what the characters are experiencing. I think it's interesting. I am, you know, we've said that we're going to cover that one day on this podcast, and like, even though it's a big game and I think it'll be kind of a slog, I'm interested in replaying.
Remember in the final boss of Nier Automata when it starts, when it's flashing back and forth between 9S and 2B, and it goes faster and faster and faster and faster, dude. God, that game is so good. Next one.
Wait, and actually, one more answer that I have to this. I'm sure you have not seen this, but Blake, you ever watched the TV series Fleabag?
No.
Fleabag, a great TV show, kind of almost feels less good in how much people have talked about how good it is, but it really is. The season two of Fleabag is like maybe the best season of television. You know, like if someone was like, what's the best one? And she does what at the beginning I thought of as the Office thing, where she just like looks at the camera. You know, she does little asides that like the other characters in the scene can't see her addressing the camera, shooting us little glances, whatever. And in both season one and season two, they then use that perspective because it's not like there's a documentary crew. There's no kind of in-universe reason that she's looking at the camera. And you think that it's just, oh, it's just like a fun little storytelling device. And then in both the first and the second season, they do like two different things with it that completely recontextualize what that camera is and like what she's doing when she looks at it.
Really?
And it rocks. It is like, okay. When it happened in the first season, it was like I felt the earth moving under me. I was like, I can't believe this is this smart. And then the second season is arguably even better with like how it treats that camera.
That's cool. I know you haven't read this book, but for the sake of podcasting, Jacob, have you ever read The Flowers of Buffoonery by Osamu Dazai?
No, I haven't.
Pretty cool book. It's only like 90 pages long. The way this book is written is that it tells the story of a failed suicide and just his hospital stay and his like friends and family kind of hanging out with him. But the narrator of the book, who is also the star of the book, is constantly interrupting the story to second guess his writing style and like try to get out ahead of the criticisms you will have of his prose as a writer. It's really fucking weird. I don't know if I really like it, but like you'll be reading it and like getting invested in what's going on with the characters, and then he'll like completely stop what he's doing to be like, God, that last paragraph is fucking terrible. What am I doing? Like, I am these are just like, you know, like shallow attempts at pity I'm trying to create in the reader. Like, I should be actually like, I don't know. It's a really cool book. You can read through it in a day. So yeah, my other answer is The Goat, Funny Games. Jacob, you gotta watch this shit. Watch the Austrian version.
Watch it. Okay.
No, you won't. Is the thing. You're not gonna watch it, but you love it. It's so rotten.
It's like, I need a night, because it's like, I'm sure it would not be it would not be to the tastes of my partner, you know, so it'd be like a night where I would have to be alone watching a movie, and that just requires me to be like, what am I gonna do on my night alone? I'm gonna watch Funny Games.
Well, speaking of my real friends, the listeners who do want to watch the movies I recommend them, read this next question.
My question is about Blake's movies. I was wondering if you had or could update a document with the movies you suggest on the pod. I'm often listening when driving or out for a run, and I hear movies which sound amazing or interesting, but then I can never remember the names. I know this is a me problem. I could just go through and listen to them again to find the movies, but you've mentioned so many. Also, any other listeners in Wales, United Kingdom, from Mark.
Mark, this is not a you problem exclusively. We actually get a lot of comments about
yeah,
this.
Yeah, a lot of people mention this.
So we used to do this. So there are definitely, if you go to some of the other bonus podcasts, you can find like master lists of them, but we stopped doing it. So we're going to, we're going to come up with a solution to that where we can like update. Maybe it'll just be like a Google Doc that's publicly available or something. But
yeah,
I'll figure it out. So yes, Mark, we'll do it.
All right. You want to read this one?
Yes. This comes from Seth. With regards to the comments about lazy eyes in the bonus episode, for anyone who's not a Nebula subscriber, we talked about the holdovers where Paul Giamatti's character has a lazy eye that switches from his left to right eye seemingly at random, and yep, there's no explanation as to why. With regards to comments about lazy eyes in the bonus episode, I don't have exactly the same thing, but I don't have binocular vision. One of my eyes appears as lazy, but when I switch which eye I'm mainly looking through, the eye that looks lazy changes. It gets more obvious when I'm tired. This comes from Seth. So
that is really interesting.
There you go.
Owen writes in and says, I am the one Southern Caribbean listener. Let's go.
Yeah.
I was listening to an old episode of the show and heard you guys shouting out the international listeners. This has an asterisk because I didn't move back to the U.S. But in 2023, I was with my grandfather in Grenada and Barbados. The islands are absolutely amazing, and I call it the anti-New York because everything is green and everyone is nice. When cleaning or cooking, I'd often listen to the podcast. I'm also a big Metal Gear Solid fan. I've been loving the recent episodes. Thank you, guys. Thank you, Owen.
Absolutely. Owen sent pictures as well of Grenada and Barbados, and they looked incredible. So I'm about to be the one Southern Caribbean host of this podcast. All right, so this comes from Brett. Hey, y'all, best explanation I could find for why Metal Gear's roar like a dinosaur is the sonar system gets triggered above water if the Metal Gear is amphibious. I like this one a lot. If the heat, it's a heat exhaust function, because a system like that has got to generate a ton of heat it needs to release. It might just make the kind of noise when it appears. Otacon, when making the Metal Gear for the first MGS, left it as a Godzilla Easter egg that stuck around in later versions that copied from it. This is all speculation, but it was fun to think about. Thank you for the great show. Thank you.
The heat exhaust one is awesome, because then that would also mean that it would essentially have heat breath, that it's like, and it would like roast anything in front of it.
Two more.
Wiley says, throughout the Metal Gear Solid series is a bunch of mixing of themes regarding gender and sexuality, with you both, which you both touch on. There is a trend for the most distinctly queer characters to be the villains of the series, i.e. Vamp, the first video game canon bisexual. Even Raiden's androgyny also seems to exist specifically to poke buttons with the audience. But as mentioned, even Snake has extremely intimate moments with other men, to the point where they're more captivating than any of his female love interests. It's to the point where it is definitely a theme throughout the game, continuing distinctly into 3 and 4. But do you think there's actually something to this? Is Kojima just fascinated with queerness, either comedically or aesthetically? Or is it some kind of statement about masculinity and sexuality you guys think he's trying to make? If it is a statement, it feels kind of half-baked, but there's definitely enough there to unpack, and I'd love to hear y'all's thoughts. From Wiley.
I don't know if I'm particularly equipped to answer this question as a person who isn't queer, but it is something I've thought about playing these games. I think maybe Kojima has a bit of a crass fascination with queerness. Do I think Kojima's queer? I don't know. But like the Otacon Snake ending of MGS1 is like intimate, and it's like in my headcanon. I'm like, oh, they love each other in a way that like was compelling and interesting, but I don't feel equipped to speak on the queerness of the MGS games personally.
I don't think Kojima's queer. Maybe he is. Maybe he could surprise me. I think half-baked is how a lot of ideas in the Metal Gear Solid universe exist. I don't think it's a purely comedic interest. I think my guess is that Kojima is very interested, as a lot of military fiction is, with the incredibly strong bonds that can develop between men who are in the military together, which is this kind of, you know, like the funny side of this is like the volleyball game in Top Gun or whatever, yeah, because it does lend itself to homoeroticism. But I also think that it speaks to like our society's very narrow definition of love. You know, that it's like, there is no doubt in my mind that Snake and Otacon love each other. And I think the Metal Gear Solid 1 ending is supposed to imply that they love each other. But, like, I don't think that Kojima conceptualizes that as romantic. I think that he is just, like, these two men know each other intimately in a way that has, like, brought them very close together. They're not gonna go, like, have sex in a, you know, cabin in the Alaskan wilderness, in his version of the story. My version of the story? Maybe they do. But, like, I think that he is interested in, you know, bonds between people, connections between men, and also, I am sure that it's something he's thought about, and I think probably finds, he'd be like, I think it's objectively interesting that Vamp is a bisexual, because it means that, you know, his genes, some bullshit, you know, and it would be like, I don't think he's homophobic, but I don't think that he's, like, I don't think he's overly sensitive. I think he probably views queerness as, like, fascinating more than anything.
Yeah. He's also really going through it with his obsession with Hunter Schafer right now, which is a whole other can of worms, perhaps. I don't know, man.
She is too young for you to be this obsessed with.
He's 60 years old. I think he's trying his best in the way that 60-year-old men sometimes do. I also think for all the over-explaining he likes to do in his narratives, he very often does not put much thought into what he does or what he says. But nonetheless, in my headcanon, they did go to that cabin, they did have sex, and it was wonderful and beautiful, and we all loved it.
Yep.
Okay, last question. This comes from Clover Darling. In Game Champ 3000's YouTube video, The Greatest Twist in Video Game History is a Lie, she compares Metal Gear Solid 2's themes of misinformation to the game's deceptive marketing that infamously hid Raiden's existence from audiences. They even released fake trailers showing Solid Snake in areas where only Raiden is playable in-game. Do you think that this deliberately deceptive marketing was an intentional metatextual extension of the game's themes or misinformation in the internet age, or was it a no-spoilers precaution like Abby being playable in The Last of Us 2, or was it just a case of audience trolling or some secret fourth thing? I will say, not for nothing, someone did write in and send screenshots of EGM's review at the time, which just blatantly spoiled that Raiden was the playable character, which I found pretty interesting. There was no byline, which was weird. I couldn't figure out who wrote the main review. There was, like, the additional thoughts bylines. But
I feel like game magazines used to do that all the time. Just I know. Like, all wrote it.
I think Mark McDonald maybe did one of the additional thoughts, because they would do, like, here's four other editors' takes on it, and maybe John Ricciardi, but nevertheless. I don't know. It's interesting.
I think that this Metal Gear Solid 2 cannot be properly understood if you don't understand that it is subverting player expectations.
Sure.
You know, and so to that extent, the trailers are a part of the narrative because it cannot set... Like, if you know that Raiden's coming, Raiden doesn't work. You know, like, you need to be surprised by him. And so,
We knew he was coming. And it still worked for us. We knew he was... I get what you mean.
But it's like, we knew that he was a surprise.
Right.
You know,
right,
like, if the game says, and halfway through you'll switch to the new protagonist of Metal Gear Solid, then it would, you know, whatever. And so, like, I don't think that necessarily the idea was, like, we're going to show how the internet is an unreliable resource by putting fake information in these trailers. But I think it is, like, metatextually important that you know that they were kind of, people were being lied to before the beginning of the game.
But the Abby thing, I don't know. Part of me is like, you could have just said you played it as her. It still would have been interesting.
Yeah, I don't... I mean, because you play as her in, like, the opening moments of the game.
Yeah. I really don't know.
I mean, it's like, I understand. That story certainly does have things that could be spoiled, but I think the structure of the game is more of a spoiler than just the fact that you play as Abby.
Yeah. I don't know. You want to wrap it up?
Yeah. Let's see. There's something that I wanted to mention where on one of the podcasts, I said that it didn't seem like there were any plans to make the big shell the first part of the game. And so it was strange that they were giving you all the tutorials. Technically incorrect. In fact, you can just start playing from Big Show. You can, like, skip the tanker section, which would be a wild way of playing through that game. But, like, you can do it, and you don't need to... You don't need to beat it first, you know, like you just have that option from the beginning. So that's interesting. I saw someone kind of calling me out on Twitter about that, which is fine. Just email somethingrottenpodcast@gmail.com. Yeah. We're going to get things wrong. But yeah, I thought that was interesting. I've been just watching Metal Gear Solid videos. I watched the whole like Metal Gear Solid Iceberg video the other day. Hour and a half long. I was thinking about. Like, I was like, why do these games feel so distinct and different in kind of how many, like, details they include? It's like, I feel like there are lots of games now that have, like, Easter eggs, but I can't think of, like, really linear games where the Easter eggs are, like, strange mechanical things that you can do, right? You know, usually it's like, oh, in the corner of this open world, there's, like, a shack, and the shack has something surprising in it. Not, like, the characters can have a weird interaction if you, like, use this item next to them.
Yeah, or it's, like, the Dishonored games where it's, like, oh, if you go into this building, you'll find, like, an environmental story. You know, like, it's...
Mm-hmm.
In a lot of ways, MGS2 feels so much more granular with its Easter eggs, or, like, specific, maybe, is a better word.
Yeah, I mean, I was looking at... Metal Gear Solid 4 is the best for this. Like, that game... The secrets in that game are bananas. But there's, like... There's one part in the forest where you can find this concrete plaque, and the plaque has all of the handprints of, like, the developers who made the game just in it. And then if you, like, lie down on that plaque... Your, like, camo will absorb it, so you can walk around with just a bunch of handprints on you. And there's the whole thing with, like, ghosts, like, the developer ghost pictures, where if you take pictures in certain parts of the game, you will, like, see images of the developers. And it's just, it's so cool. And I don't know. I think it's maybe, like, I think games are so complicated now that even getting them running at all is a miracle. And so there's less room to, like, put in a bunch of weird shit.
Like, 10 years ago, well, no, I guess it would have been 2016, so it would have been 8 years ago, I did this story for Polygon about Easter eggs. It's where I interviewed teams about how they, like, put them in games and stuff, and, like, the headline was the costs of developing Easter eggs, and I talked to, like, the Witcher team and the Dying Light team and the Stanley Parable team guy, not Davey Reed and the other one.
Yeah, I know who you're talking about.
Anyway, point of bringing this up is, man, I really screwed the pooch by not trying to get some MGS stuff in that story. Also, who knows if the story's any good.
Yeah, because it is, you know, it's like, you can kind of think of, the story is always just like, a developer thought this would be cool, and they, like, made it on their own time, and they put it in, and, like, wow, it's there, it's neat. But, like, when your game is so tightly, like, you know, 5 million systems working together... Adding one thing like that feels way more difficult. I'm not a game developer. I don't know if that's actually the case, but it just, like, you know, if thinking about something like The Last of Us 2 or whatever, like, having a very specific enemy behavior that only happens when you, like, hit them with a weapon that you only get after beating the game,
that just
seems like it's not something that's gonna happen, right?
Jacob, there's an interesting detail in this story by Blake Hester of Polygon fame.
Wow, what is it?
Like Techland, a bit of the Stanley Parable's development budget was taken up by Easter eggs. The fun wasn't free. And according to William Pugh, that's who I interviewed from the Stanley Parable, that bit took up a lot more than Techland's estimated 2%. He estimates Easter eggs and secrets took up 30% of the Stanley Parable's budget.
Well, the Stanley Parable is kind of like, what if we made a game out of Easter eggs, right?
He points out, though, that there was no set in stone budget for the game. During development, neither he or Reedon collected checks. There was no kind of money deal. There was no budget for the game. We ended up spending like 10 grand overall over the 2 years on the game. I now think I owe Polygon money for reading that much of their story on the podcast.
Yeah, but you wrote it. They probably paid you like $400 for that story.
Polygon, I don't know what it's like now. Back in the day, they had crazy good rates.
Wow. Okay. Well, the world is worse now.
Yeah, so I don't know what it's like these days. You know, I haven't written there in many years. Maybe they're even better. Let's go. Gotta go. Keep talking about this.
All right. Well, that's it for our Metal Gear Solid season. Please listen to our bonus episode, not just because we reveal what game series we are doing next, but also because it's really good. Ben Hansen and Dan Reichert, great fucking time on the pod. Blake, we are going to be doing also a Nebula exclusive on The Last of Us 2, like, extra things have come out. The remaster, the lost levels, the roguelike mode, and the grounded documentary. We have a lot of thoughts on that. So another reason to jump on Nebula. If you're subscribed to Nebula, get the RSS feed, blah, blah, blah. Yep. And now we're going to take like a month-long break, basically. At the beginning of, or at the end of last year, we said we're going to do our shows every other week. We changed our minds. Now we're still doing them every week, but between series, we're taking a break, so we have time to basically start recording the next season. So, everyone, enjoy this break. Go back and listen to your favorite episodes of Something Rotten. And we'll see you in, like, the middle of March.
Did we change our minds? Or did advertisers change our minds? You know, that's the eternal question.
That's right, Blake. We live in a simulation.
Bye.
Bye.